and against. Then it will be too late." His hand went to his sword. Kalin's eyes widened. "If he were here, in my place, he would pull this sword and have your help or have your head." He took his hand away. "That, my friend, is why I cannot harm you if you choose not to help me." The birdman sat quiet and still for a while. "I can see now that I do not want Darkenrall for an enemy. Or you." He got up and went to the door, casting the hawk into the sky. The birdman sat once more, sighing heavily with the weight of his thoughts. "Your words seem to flow true, but I cannot know for sure yet. It would also seem that although you want us to help you, you also wish to help us. I believe you are sincere in this. It is a wise man who seeks help by helping, and not by threats or tricks. If I wanted to get your help by tricks, I would have let you believe me to be a spirit." The corners of the birdman's mouth turned up in a small smile. "If we had held a gathering, we would have discovered you were not. A wise man would suspect that, too. So which reason is it that made you tell the truth? You did not want to trick us, or you were afraid to?"
Richard smiled back. "In truth, both."
The birdman nodded. "Thank you for the truth." Richard sat quietly, took a deep breath, and let it out slowly.
"So, birdman, I have told you my tale. You must judge it true or not. Time works against me. Will you help?"
"It is not that simple. My people look to me for direction. If you asked for food, I could say, 'Give him food,' and they would do so. But you have asked for a gathering. That is different. The Council of Seers are the six elders you spoke to, plus myself. They are old men, firm in the ways of their past. An outsider has never been given a gathering before, never been permitted to disturb the peace of our ancestor spirits. Soon these six will join the ancestor spirits, and they do not want to think they will be called from the spirit world for an outsider's needs. If they break the tradition, they will be forever burdened with the results. I cannot order them to do this."
"It is not only an outsider's needs," Kalin said, telling them both her words. "Helping us also helps the mud people."
"Maybe in the end," the birdman said, "but not in the beginning."
"What if I were one of the mud people?" Richard asked, his eyes narrowing.
"Then they would call the gathering for you, and not violate the tradition."
"Could you make me one of the mud people?"
The birdman's silver-gray hair glistened in the firelight as he considered. "If you were to first do something that helped our people, something that benefited them, with no advantage to you, proved you were a man of good intentions toward us, doing so without promise of aid for your help, and the elders wished it, I could.
And once you named me as one of the mud people, I could ask for a gathering and they would call it.
If you were one of us, they would know you had our interests in your heart. They would call a council of seers to help you."
"And if they called the council, would they be able to tell me where the object I seek is located?"
"I cannot answer that. Sometimes the spirits will not answer our questions. Sometimes they do not know the answers to our questions. There is no guarantee that we could help you, even if we held a gathering. All I could promise is that we would try our best."
Richard looked down at the ground, thinking. With his finger, he pushed some dirt into one of the puddles where the rain dripped.
"Kalin," he asked quietly, "do you know of anyone else who would have the power to tell us where to look for the box?" Kalin had been giving this consideration all day. "I do. But of all the ones I know of, I do not know of any who would be any more eager to help us than the mud people are. Some would kill us just for asking."
"Well, of the ones who wouldn't kill us just for asking, how far away are they?" 3 weeks at least, north, through very dangerous country controlled by Rawl. 3 weeks, Richard said out loud with a heavy tone of disappointment. But Richard, the Birdman is able to promise us precious little. If you could find a way to help them, if it pleases the elders, if they ask the Birdman to name you one of the Mud People, if the Council of Seers can get an answer, if the spirits even know the answer, if, many opportunities for a wrong step. Was it not you who told me I would have to win them over? He asked with a smile. It was. So, what do you think? Do you think we should stay and try to convince them to help, or we should go to find the answers elsewhere? She shook her head slowly. I think you are the seeker, and you will have to decide. He smiled again. You are my friend. I could use your advice. She hooked some hair behind her ear. I don't know what advice to give, Richard, and my life, too, depends upon you making the right choice. But as your friend, I have faith that you will decide wisely. Will you hate me, he grinned, if I make the wrong choice? She looked into his gray eyes, eyes that could see into her, eyes that made her weak with longing. Even if you choose wrong, and it costs me my life, she whispered, swallowing back the lump in her throat, I could never hate you. He looked away from her, back down at the dirt a while, then once again up to the Birdman. Do your people like having roofs that leak? The Birdman raised an eyebrow. Would you like it if water dripped on your face when you were asleep? Smiling, Richard shook his head. Then why don't you make roofs that don't leak? The Birdman shrugged. Because it cannot be done. We have no materials at hand to use. Clay bricks are too heavy and would fall down. Wood is too scarce. It must be carried long distances. Grass is all we have. And it leaks. Richard took one of the pottery bowls and turned it upside down under one of the drips. You have clay from which you make pottery. Our ovens are small. We could not make a pot that big. And besides, it would crack. Then it too would leak. It cannot be done. It is a mistake to say something cannot be done simply because you don't know how to do it. I would not be here otherwise. He said this gently, without malice. Your people are strong and wise. I would be honored if the Birdman would allow me to teach his people how to make roofs that do not leak, and also let the smoke out at the same time. The Birdman considered this without showing any emotion. If you could do this, it would be a great benefit to my people, and they would give you many thanks. But I can make no promises beyond that. Richard shrugged. None asked for. The answer may still be no. You must accept that, if that is the answer, and bring no harm to my people. I will do my best for your people, and hope only that they judge me fairly. Then you are free to try. But I cannot see how you will make a roof of clay that will not crack and leak. I will make you a roof for your spirit house that will have 1,000 cracks, but will not leak. Then I will teach you to make more for yourselves. The Birdman smiled and gave a nod. Chapter 24 I hate my mother! The master, sitting cross-legged on the grass, looked down at the bitter expression on the boy's face and waited a moment before he answered in a quiet voice. That is a very strong thing to say, Carl. I would not want you to say something you would come to regret when you had thought it over. I've thought it over plenty, Carl snapped. We've talked about it a long time. I know now how they've twisted me around, deceived me, how selfish they are. He squinted his eyes. How they are enemies of the people! Rawl glanced up at the windows, the last tinge of fading sunlight turning the wisps of clouds a beautiful deep reddish purple, frosted with tips of gold. Tonight, tonight at long last would be the night he returned to the underworld. For most of long days and nights he had kept the boy awake with a special gruel, allowing him to sleep for only brief spells, kept him awake to hammer away at him until his mind was empty and could be molded. He had talked to the boy endlessly, convincing him how others had used him, abused him, and lied to him. Sometimes he had left the boy to think over what he had been told, and use the excuse to visit his father's tomb and read the sacred inscriptions again, or to snatch some rest. And then, last night, he had taken that girl to his bed, to get some relaxation, a small momentary diversion, an interlude of gentleness to feel another's soft flesh against his, to relieve his pent-up excitement. She should have been honored, especially after he had been so tender with her, so charming. She had been anxious enough to be with him. But what did she do? She laughed. When she saw the scars, she laughed. As he thought of it now, Rawl had to strain to control his rage, strain to show the boy a smile, strain to hide his impatience to get on with it. He thought of what he had done to the girl, the exhilaration of his violence unleashed, her ripping screams. The smile came more easily to his lips. She would laugh at him no more. "What's the big grin for?" Carl asked. Rawl looked down at the boy's big brown eyes. "I was just thinking about how proud I am of you." His smile widened as he remembered the way her hot, sticky blood pumped and spurted as she screamed. Where was her haughty laughter then?
"Me?"
Carl asked, smiling shyly. Rawl's blonde head nodded. "Yes, Carl, you. Not many young men of your age would be intelligent enough to see the world as it really is, to see beyond their own lives to the wider dangers and wonders all about, to see how hard I work to bring safety and peace to the people." He shook his head sadly. "Sometimes it hurts my heart to see the very ones for whom I struggle so hard turn their backs to me, reject my tireless efforts, or worse yet, join with the enemies of the people. I have not wanted to burden you with worry for me, but right now, as I speak with you, there are evil people who plot to conquer us, to crush us. They have brought down the boundary that protected Dahara, and now the second boundary, too. I fear they plot an invasion. I have tried to warn the people of the danger from Westland, to get them to do something to protect themselves, but they are poor and simple people. They look to me for protection." Carl's eyes widened.
"Father Rawl, are you in danger?"
Rawl brushed the matter away with a wave of his hand. "It's not me I fear for, it's the people. If I were to die, who would protect them?"
"Die?"
Carl's eyes filled with tears.
"Oh, Father Rawl, we need you. Please don't let them get you. Please let me fight at your side. I want to help protect you. I couldn't stand the thought of you getting hurt."
Rawl's breathing quickened. His heart raced. The time was near. It would not be long now. He smiled warmly at Carl as he remembered the girl's hoarse screams. "I could not stand the thought of you being in danger for me. Carl, I have come to know you these last days. You are more to me than simply a young man who was chosen to help me with a ceremony. You have become my friend. I have shared my deepest concerns with you, my hopes, my dreams. I don't do that with many. It's enough to know you care." Tears in his eyes, Carl looked up at the master.
"Father Rawl," he whispered, "I'd do anything for you. Please let me stay. After the ceremony, let me stay and be with you. I'll do anything you need, I promise, if I could just stay with you."
"Carl, that's so like you, so kind. But you have a life, parents, friends,
and Tinker,"
Don't forget your dog. Soon you will be wanting to go back to all that. Carl slowly shook his head while his eyes stayed on Rawl. No, I won't. I only want to be with you. Father Rawl, I love you. I'd do anything for you. Rawl considered the boy's words, a serious look on his face. It would be dangerous for you to stay with me. Rawl could feel his heart pounding.
I don't care. I want to serve you. I don't care if I might get killed. I only want to help you. I don't want to do anything else but help you in your fight with those enemies. Father Rawl, if I got killed helping you, it would be worth it. Please, let me stay. I'll do whatever you ask. Forever.
To help control his rapid breathing, Rawl took a deep breath and let it out slowly. His face was grave. Are you sure of what you are saying, Carl? Are you sure you really mean it? I mean, are you really sure you would give your life for me?
I swear, I'd die to help you. My life is yours, if you'll have it.
Rawl leaned back a little, put his hands on his knees, and nodded slowly. His blue eyes riveted on the boy.
Yes, Carl. I will have it.
Carl didn't smile, but shook slightly with the excitement of acceptance, his face set in determination.
When can we do the ceremony? I want to help you and the people.
Soon, Rawl said, his eyes getting wide and his speech slow. Tonight, after I have fed you. Are you ready to begin?
Yes.
Rawl rose, feeling the surge of blood through his veins. He strained to control the flush of arousal. It was dark outside. The torches gave off a flickering light that danced in his blue eyes, gleamed on his long blonde hair, and made his white robes seem to glow. Before going to the forge room, he placed the feeding horn near Carl's mouth. Inside the dark room, his guards waited, their massive arms folded across their chests. Sweat rolling from their skin left little trails in the light covering of soot. A crucible sat in the fire of the forge, an acrid smell rising from the dross. Eyes wide, Rawl addressed his guards.
Is Demon back?
For several days, master.
Tell him to come and wait,
Rawl said, unable to manage more than a whisper.
And then I would like you two to leave me alone for now.
They bowed and left through the back door. Rawl swept his hand over the crucible, and the smell changed to an appetizing aroma. His eyes closed as he offered silent prayers to the spirit of his father. His breathing was a shallow pant. In the fervor of his emotions, he was unable to control it. He licked his shaking fingertips and rubbed them on his lips. Affixing wooden handles to the crucible so as to lift it without burning himself, he used the magic to make its weight easy to maneuver, and went back through the door with it. The torches lit the area around the boy, the white sand with the symbols traced in it, the ring of grass, the altar set on the wedge of white stone. Torchlight reflected off the polished stone block that held the iron bowl with the shinga on its lid. Rawl's blue eyes took it all in as he approached the boy. He stopped in front of him, by the mouth of the feeding horn. There was a glaze in his eyes as he looked down to Carl's upturned face.
Are you sure about this, Carl? He asked hoarsely. Can I trust you with my life? I swear my loyalty to you, Father Rawl. Forever.
Rawl's eyes closed as he drew a sharp breath. Sweat beaded on his face, stuck his robes to his skin. He could feel waves of heat rolling off the crucible. He added the heat of his magic to the vessel to keep its contents boiling.
Softly he began chanting the sacred incantations in the ancient language. Charms and spells whispered their haunting sounds in the air.
Rawl's back arched as he felt power surging through his body, taking him with hot promise. He shook as he chanted, offering up his words to the spirit of the boy. His eyes opened part way, the visage of wanton passion burning in them. His breathing was ragged, his hands trembled slightly. He gazed down at the boy.
"Carl," he said in a husky whisper, "I love you.
I love you, Father Rawl."
Rawl's eyes slid closed. "Put your mouth over the horn, my boy, and hold tight." While Carl did as he was told, Rawl chanted the last charm, his heart pounding. The torches hissed and spit while they burned, the sound intertwining with that of the spell. And then he poured the contents of the crucible into the horn.
Carl's eyes snapped wide, and he both inhaled and swallowed involuntarily when the molten lead hit him, searing into his body.
Tarkenrall shuddered with excitement. He let the empty crucible slip from his hands to the ground. The master went on to the next set of incantations, the sending of the boy's spirit to the underworld. He said the words, every word in the proper order, opening the way to the underworld, opening the void, opening the dark emptiness. As his hands extended upward, dark forms swirled around him. Howls filled the night air with the terror of their calls. Tarkenrall went to the cold stone altar, knelt in front of it, stretched his arm across it, put his face to it. He spoke the words in the ancient language that would link the boy's spirit to him. For a short while he cast the needed spells. When finished, he stood, fists at his side, his face flushed. Demon Nass stepped forward out of the shadows.
Rawl's vision focused on his friend.
"Demon," he whispered, his voice coarse.
"Master Rawl," he answered in greeting, bowing his head.
Rawl stepped to Demon, his face drawn and sweat-streaked.
"Take his body from the ground and put it on the altar.
Use the bucket of water to wash him clean." He glanced down at the short sword Demon wore. "Crack his skull for me, no more. And then you may stand back and wait."
He passed his hands over Demon's head. The air about shuddered.
"This spell will protect you. Wait for me, then, until I return, just before dawn. I will need you."
He looked away, lost in his thoughts. Demon did as asked, going about the grim task while Rawl continued to chant the strange words, rocking back and forth, his eyes closed as if in a trance. Demon wiped his sword clean on his muscular forearm and returned it to its scabbard. He took one last look at Rawl, who was still lost in the trance.
"I hate this part," he muttered to himself.
He turned and went back into the shadows of the trees, leaving the master to his work. Tarkenrall went to stand behind the altar, breathing in deeply. Suddenly he cast his hand down at the fire pit, and the flames leapt up with a roar. He held out both hands, fingers contorted, and the iron bowl lifted and floated over, setting itself down on the fire. Rawl pulled his curved knife from its sheath and laid it on the boy's wet belly. He slipped his robes from his shoulders and let them drop to the ground, kicking them back out of the way. Sweat covered his lean form, ran down his neck in rivulets.
His skin was smooth and taut over his well-proportioned muscles, except on his upper left thigh, across part of his hip and abdomen, and the left side of his erect sex. That was where the scar was, where the flames sent by the old wizard had tasted him, the flames of the wizard's fire that had consumed his father as he stood at his right hand, flames that had licked him also, giving him the pain of the wizard's fire. It had been a fire unlike any other, burning, sticking, searing, alive with purpose, as he had screamed until he had lost his voice. Darkenrall licked his fingers, and reaching down ran them wetly over the bumpy scars. How he had so badly wanted to do that when he had been burned. How he had so badly wanted to do it to stop the terror of the unrelenting pain and burning. But the healers wouldn't let him. They said he mustn't touch the burn. And so they bound him by his wrists to keep him from reaching down. He had licked his fingers, and instead rubbed them on his lips as he shook, to try to stop his crying, and on his eyes to try to wipe away the vision of having seen his father burned alive. For months he had cried and panted and begged to touch and soothe the burns, but they would not let him. How he hated the wizard! How he wanted to kill him! How he wanted to push his hand into the wizard's living body while he looked into his eyes and pull his heart out! Darkenrall took his fingers away from the scar, and picking up the knife, put the thoughts of that time out of his mind. He was a man now. He was the master. He put his mind back to the matter at hand. He wove the proper spell, and then plunged the knife into the boy's chest. With care, he removed the heart and put it into the iron bowl of boiling water. Next, he removed the brain and added it to the bowl. Last, he took the testicles and added them, too. Then, finally, he put the knife down. Blood mixed with the sweat that covered him. It dripped from his elbows. He laid his arms across the body and offered prayers to the spirits. His face lifted to the dark windows above as he closed his eyes and continued the incantations, rolling them out without having to think. For an hour he went on with the words of the ceremony, smearing the blood on his chest at the proper time. When he had finished with the runes from his father's tomb, he went to the sorcerer's sand where the boy had been buried for the time of his testing. With his arms he smoothed the sand. It stuck to the blood in a white crust. Squatting, he carefully began drawing the symbols, radiating from the center axis, branching in intricate patterns learned in years of study. He concentrated as he worked into the night, his straight blonde hair hanging down, his brow wrinkled with intensity as he added each element, leaving out no line or stroke or curve, for that would be fatal. At last finished, he went to the sacred bowl and found the water almost boiled away, as it should be. With magic, he floated the bowl back to the polished stone block and let it cool a little before he took a stone pestle and began grinding. He mashed, sweat running from his face, until he had worked the heart, brain, and testicles into a paste, to which he added magic powders from pockets in his discarded robes. Standing in front of the altar, he held up the bowl with the mixture while he cast the calling spells. He lowered the bowl when finished, and looked around at the Garden of Life. He always liked to look upon beautiful things before he went to the underworld. With his fingers, he ate from the bowl. He hated the taste of meat, and never ate anything but plants. Now, though, there was no choice. The way was the way. If he wanted to go to the underworld, he had to eat the flesh. He ignored the taste, and ate it all, trying to think of it as vegetable paste. Licking his fingers clean, he set the bowl down and went to sit cross-legged on the grass in front of the white sand. His blonde hair was matted in places with dried blood. He placed his hands palm up on his knees, closed his eyes, and took deep breaths, preparing himself for meeting the spirit of the boy. At last ready, all preparation done, all charms spoken, all spells cast, the master raised his head and opened his eyes. "Come to me, Carl," he whispered in the secret ancient language. There was a moment of dead silence, and then a wailing roar. The ground shook. From the center of the sand, the center of the enchantment, the boy's spirit rose in the form of the Shinga, the underworld beast. The Shinga came, transparent at first, like smoke rising from the ground, turning as if unscrewing itself from the white sand, lured by the drawing. Its head reared as it struggled to pull itself through the drawing, snorting steam from its flared nostrils. Rawl calmly watched as the fearsome beast rose, becoming solid as it came, ripping the ground and pulling the sand up with it, its powerful hind legs pulling through at last as it reared with a wail. A hole opened, black as pitch. Sand around the edges fell away into the bottomless blackness. The Shinga floated above it. Piercing brown eyes looked down at Rawl. "Thank you for coming, Carl." The beast bent forward, nuzzling its muzzle against the master's bare chest. Rawl came to his feet and stroked the Shinga's head as it bucked, calming its impatience to be off. When at last it quieted, Rawl climbed onto its back and held its neck tight. With a flash of light, the Shinga, dark and Rawl astride its back, dissolved back into the black void, corkscrewing itself down as it went. The ground shuddered and the hole closed with a grating sound. The Garden of Life was left in the sudden silence of the night. From the shadows of the trees, Demon Nass stepped forward, forehead beaded with sweat.
"Safe journey, my friend," he whispered. "Safe journey."
Chapter 25. The rain held off for the time being, but the sky remained thickly overcast, as it had been for almost as long as she could remember. Sitting alone on a small bench against the wall of another building, Kaelin smiled to herself as she watched Richard construct the roof of the spirit house. Sweat ran off his bare back, over the swell of his muscles, over the scars where the gar's claws had raked his back. Richard was working with Svidlin and some other men, teaching them. He had told her he didn't need her to translate, that working with one's hands was universal, and if they had to partly figure it out themselves, they would understand it better and have more pride in what they had done. Svidlin kept jabbering questions Richard didn't understand. Richard just smiled and explained things in words the others couldn't understand, using his hands in a sign language he invented as needed. Sometimes the others thought it hilarious, and all would end up laughing. They had accomplished a lot, for men who didn't understand each other. At first, Richard hadn't told her what he was doing. He just smiled and said she would have to wait and see. First, he took blocks of clay, about 1 by 2 feet, and made wave-like forms. Half the block's face was a concave trough, like a gutter, the other half a long, rounded hump, He hollowed them out and asked the women who worked the pottery to fire them. Next, he attached two uniform strips of wood to a flat board, one to each side, and put a lump of soft clay into the center. Using a rolling pin, he flattened the clay, the two strips of wood acting as a thickness gauge. Slicing off the excess at the top and bottom of the board, he ended up with slabs of clay of a uniform thickness and size, which he draped and smoothed over the forms the women had fired for him. He used a stick to poke a hole in the two upper corners. The women followed him around, inspecting his work closely, so he enlisted their help. Soon he had a whole crew of smiling, chatting women making the slabs and forming them, showing him how to do it better. When the slabs were dry, they could be pulled from the forms. While these were being fired, the women, by then buzzing with curiosity, made more. When they asked how many they should make, he said to just keep making them. Richard left them to their new work and went to the spirit house, and began making a fireplace out of the mud bricks that were used for the buildings. Svidlin followed him around, trying to learn everything. "You're making clay roofing tiles, aren't you?" Kalin had asked him.
"Yes," he had said with a smile.
"Richard, I have seen thatched roofs that do not leak."
"So have I."
"Then why not simply make their grass roofs over properly, so they don't leak?"
"Do you know how to thatch roofs?"
"No,
neither do I. But I know how to make tile roofs, so that's what I have to do."
While he was building the fireplace and showing Svidlin how to do it, he had other men strip the grass off the roof, leaving a skeleton of poles that ran the length of the building, poles that had been used to tie down each course of grass. Now they would be used to secure the clay tiles. The tiles spanned from one row of poles to the next, the bottom edge laid on the first pole, the top edge laid on the second, with the holes in the tiles used to lash them tight to the poles. The second course of tiles was laid so its bottom edge overlapped the top of the first, covering the holes that tied the tiles down, and owing to their wave-like form, each interlocked with the one before. Because the clay tiles were heavier than the grass, Richard had first reinforced the poles from underneath with supports running up the pitch of the roof, with cross members bracing them. It seemed as if half the village was engaged in the construction. The birdman came by from time to time to watch the work, pleased with what he saw. Sometimes he sat with Kalin, saying nothing. Sometimes he talked with her. But mostly he just watched. Occasionally he slipped in a question about Richard's character. Most of the time while Richard was working, Kalin was alone. The women weren't interested in her offers of help. The men kept their distance, watching her out of the corners of their eyes, and the young girls were too shy to actually bring themselves to talk to her. Sometimes she found them standing, staring at her. When she would ask their names, they would only give their shy smiles and run away. The little children wanted to approach, but their mothers kept them well clear. She wasn't allowed to help with the cooking or the making of the tiles. Her approaches were politely turned down with the excuse that she was an honored guest. She knew better. She was a confessor. They were afraid of her. Kalin was used to the attitude, the looks, the whispers. It no longer bothered her, as it had when she was younger. She remembered her mother smiling at her, telling her it was just the way people were, and it could not be changed, that she must not let it bring her to bitterness, and that she would come to be above it some day. She had thought she was beyond caring, that it didn't matter to her, that she had accepted who she was, the way life was, that she could have none of what other people had, and that it was all right. That was before she met Richard, before he became her friend, accepted her, talked to her, treated her like a normal person, cared about her. But then, Richard didn't know what she was. Svidlin, at least, had been friendly to her. He had taken her and Richard into his small home with him, his wife, Wesselin, and their young boy, Sedin, and had given them a place to sleep on the floor. Even if it was because Savidlin had insisted, Wesselin had accepted Kaelin into her home with gracious hospitality, and did not show coldness when she had the chance, unseen by her husband, to do so. At night, after it was too dark to work, Sedain would sit wide-eyed on the floor with Kaelin as she told him stories of kings and castles, of far-off lands and of fierce beasts. He would crawl into her lap and beg for more stories and give her hugs. It brought tears to her eyes now to think of how Wesselin let him do that, without pulling him away. How she had the kindness not to show her fear. When Sedain went to sleep, she and Richard would tell Savidlin and Wesselin some of the stories of their journey from Westland. Savidlin was one who respected success in struggle, and listened with eyes almost as wide as his son's had been. The birdman had seemed pleased with the new roof. Shaking his head slowly, he had smiled to himself when he had seen enough to figure out how it would work. But the other six elders were less impressed. To them, a little rain dripping in once in a while seemed hardly enough to become concerned about. It had done so their whole life, and they were resentful of an outsider coming in and showing them how stupid they had been. Some day, when one of the elders died, Savidlin would become one of the six. Kaelin wished he were one now, for they could use such a strong ally among the elders. Kaelin worried about what would happen when the roof was finished, about what would happen if the elders refused to ask to have Richard named one of the mud people. Richard had not given her his promise that he wouldn't hurt them. Even though he was not the kind of person to do something like that, he was the Seeker. More was at stake than the lives of a few of these people. Much more. The Seeker had to take that into account. She had to take that into account. Kaelin didn't know if killing the last man of the Quad had changed him, made him harder. Learning to kill made you weigh matters differently, made it easier to kill again. That was something she knew all too well. Kaelin wished so much he had not come to her aid when he had, wished he had not killed that man. She didn't have the heart to tell him it was unnecessary. She could have handled it herself. After all, one man alone was hardly a mortal danger to her. That was why Rawl always sent four men after confessors, one to be touched by her power, the other three to kill him and the confessor. Sometimes only one was left, but that was enough after a confessor had spent her power. But one alone? He had almost no chance. Even if he was big, she was faster. When he swung his sword, she would have simply jumped out of the way. Before he could have brought it up again, she would have touched him, and he would have been hers. That would have been the end of him. Kaelin knew there was no way she could ever tell Richard that there had been no need for him to kill. What made it doubly bad was that he had killed for her, had thought he was saving her. Kaelin knew another Quad was probably already on its way. They were relentless. The man Richard had killed knew he was going to die, knew he didn't stand a chance alone against a confessor, but he came anyway. They would not stop, did not know the meaning of it, never thought of anything but their objective. And they enjoyed what they did to confessors, even though she tried not to. She couldn't help remembering Denis. Whenever she thought of the Quads, she couldn't help remembering what they had done to Denis. Before Kaelin had become a woman, her mother had been stricken with a terrible sickness, one no healer was able to turn back. She had died all too quickly of the awful wasting disease. Confessors were a close sisterhood. When trouble struck one, it struck all. Denis's mother took in Kaelin and comforted her. The two girls, best friends, had been thrilled that they were to be sisters, as they called themselves from then on, and it helped ease the pain of losing her mother. Denis was a frail girl, as frail as her mother. She did not have the strength of power that Kaelin did, and over time Kaelin became her protector, guardian, shielding her from situations that required more force than she could bring from within. After its use, Kaelin could recover the strength of her power in an hour or two, but for Denis, it sometimes took several days. On one fateful day, Kaelin had been away for a short time, taking a confession from a murderer who was to be hanged, a mission that was to have been Denis's. Kaelin had gone in her sister's place because she wanted to spare Denis the torment of the task. Denis hated taking confessions, hated seeing the look in their eyes. Sometimes she would cry for days after. She never asked Kaelin to go in her stead. She wouldn't. But the look of relief on her face when Kaelin told her she would do it was words enough. Kaelin, too, disliked taking confessions. But she was stronger, wiser, more reflective. She understood and accepted that being a confessor was her power. It was who she was. And so it didn't hurt her the way it did Denis. Kaelin had always been able to place her head before her heart, and she would have done any dirty job in Denis' place. On the trail home, Kaelin heard soft whimpers from the brush at the side of the road, moans of mortal pain. To her horror, she discovered Denis, thrown there, discarded. "I was coming to meet you. I wanted to walk back with you," Denis had said as Kaelin cradled the girl's head in her lap. "A quad caught me. I'm sorry. I got one of them, Kaelin. I touched him. I got one of them. You would have been proud of me." In shock, Kaelin held Denis' head, comforted her, telling her it would be all right. "Please, Kaelin, pull my dress down for me." Her voice sounded as if it were coming from a faraway place, wet and weak. "My arms don't work." Past panic, Kaelin saw why. Denis' arms had been brutally broken. They lay useless at her sides, bent in places where they shouldn't be bent. Blood trickled from one ear. Kaelin pulled what was left of the blood-soaked dress over her sister, covering her as best she could. Her head spun with the horror of what the men had done. The choking feeling in her throat wouldn't let words come out. She strained to hold back her screams, fearful of frightening her sister any more. She knew she had to be strong for her, this one last time. Denis whispered Kaelin's name, beckoning her closer.
"Darkenrall did this to me. He wasn't here, but he did this to me."
"I know," Kaelin said with all the tenderness she could gather.
"Lie still. It will be all right. I will take you home."
She knew it was a lie, knew Denis would not be all right.
"Please, Kaelin," she whispered. "Kill him. Stop this madness. I wish I was strong enough. Kill him for me."
Anger boiled up in her. It was the first time Kaelin had ever wanted to use her power to hurt someone, to kill someone. She had gone to the brink of feeling something she had never felt before or since. A terrible wrath, a force from deep within, a frightening birthright. With shaking fingers, she stroked Denis' bloody hair.
"I will," she promised.
Denis relaxed back in her arms. Kaelin took off the bone necklace and placed it around her sister's neck.
"I want you to have this. It will help protect you."
"Thank you, Kaelin." She smiled, tears rolling from her wide eyes down the pale skin of her cheeks.
"But nothing can protect me now. Save yourself. Don't let them get you. They enjoy it. They hurt me so much, and they enjoyed it. They laughed at me."
Kaelin closed her eyes against the sickening sight of her sister's pain, rocked her in her arms, and kissed her forehead.
"Remember me, Kaelin," Remember the fun we had.
Bad memories?
Kaylin's head snapped up, jolted out of her thoughts. The birdman stood beside her, having come up silently, unnoticed. She nodded, looking away from his gaze.
"Please forgive me for showing weakness," she said, clearing her throat as her fingers wiped the tears from her face.
He regarded her with soft brown eyes and sat lightly beside her on the short bench.
"It is not a weakness, child, to be a victim."
She wiped her nose on the back of her hand and swallowed back the wail that was trying to fight its way out of her throat.
She felt so alone.
She so missed Denis. The birdman put his arm tenderly around her shoulder and gave her a short, fatherly hug.
"I was thinking of my sister, Denis. She was murdered by order of Darkan Rall. I found her. She died in my arms. They hurt her so bad.
Rall is not content to kill. He must see to it that people suffer before they die."
He nodded his understanding. "Though we be different peoples, we hurt the same."
With his thumb he brushed a tear from her cheek, then reached into his pocket.
"Hold out your hand."
She did as he asked, and he poured some small seeds in it. Surveying the sky, he blew the whistle that made no sound, the one that hung from his neck, and shortly a small, bright, yellow bird lit with a flutter upon his finger. He placed his hand next to hers so it could climb over and eat the seeds. Kaylin could feel its tiny little feet gripping her finger while it pecked away at the seeds. The bird was so bright and pretty it made her smile. The birdman's leathery face smiled with her. When it finished eating, the bird fluffed itself up and sat contentedly, without fear.
"I thought you might like to gaze upon a small vision of beauty among the ugliness."
"Thank you," she smiled.
"Do you wish to keep him?"
Kaylin watched the bird a moment longer, its bright yellow feathers, the way it cocked its head, and then cast it into the air.
"I have no right," she said, watching the bird flit away. "It should be free."
A small smile brightened the birdman's face as he gave a single nod. Leaning forward and resting his forearms on his knees, he looked over at the spirit house. The work was almost done, maybe one more day. Long, silver-gray hair slipped off his shoulders and down around his face, hiding his expression from her. Kaylin sat a while and watched Richard working on the roof. She ached to have him hold her right now, and hurt all the more because she knew she couldn't allow it.
"You wish to kill him, this man, Darkan Rall?" he asked without turning to her.
"Very much."
"And is your power enough?"
"No," she admitted.
"And does the Seeker's Blade have enough power to kill him?"
"No. Why do you ask?"
The clouds were getting darker as the day was drawing to an end. Light rain was beginning to fall once more, and the gloom among the buildings was deepening. "As you said yourself, it is dangerous to be with a confessor who is in great want of something. I think this is also true of the Seeker. Maybe even more so."
She paused a moment, then spoke softly. "I do not wish to put words to what Darkan Rall did with his own hands to Richard's father. It would make you fear the Seeker all the more. But know that Richard would also have let the bird fly free." The birdman seemed to laugh without sound.
"You and I are too smart for these tricks with words. Let us speak without them."
He sat back and folded his arms across his chest. "I have tried to tell the other elders what a wonderful thing the Seeker is doing for our people, how good it is that he is teaching us these things. They are not so sure,
as they are set in their ways and can be stubborn, sometimes almost beyond my tolerance. I fear what you and the Seeker will do to my people if the elders say no. Richard has given you his word that he will not harm your people. Words are not as strong as a father's blood, or as strong as a sister's. Kaelin leaned back against the wall, pulling her cloak around her, shutting out the wet breeze. I am a confessor because I was born so. I did not seek the power. I would have chosen otherwise, would have chosen to be like other people. But I must live with what I was given, and make the best of it. Despite what you may think of the confessors, despite what most people think, we are here to serve the people, to serve the truth. I love all the people of the Midlands, and would give my life to protect them, to keep them free. That is all I wish to do. And yet I am alone. Richard keeps his eyes on you. He watches over you, cares for you. She looked over out of the corner of her eye. Richard is from Westland. He does not know what I am. If he knew... The birdman lifted his eyebrow at hearing this. For one who serves the truth, please do not remind me. It is trouble of my own making, with consequences I must bear, and fear greatly. And that only proves my words. The Mud People live in a land distant from the other peoples. That has given them the luxury of being out of the reach of trouble in the past. This trouble has long arms. It will reach you. The elders can argue against helping all they want, but they will not be able to argue against the fangs of truth. All of your people will pay the price if these few put pride before wisdom. The birdman listened carefully, respectfully. Kaelin turned to him. I cannot honestly say at this moment what I will do if the elders say no. It is not my wish to harm your people, but to save them from the pain I have seen. I have seen what Darkon Rall does to people. I know what he will do. If I knew I could somehow stop Rall by killing Savidlin's precious little boy, I would do it without hesitation, with my bare hands if need be, because as much as the doing of it would wound my heart, I know I would be saving all the other precious little children. It is a terrifying burden I carry, the burden of the warrior. You are one who has killed other men to save others, and I know you take no joy in it. Darkon Rall takes joy in it, believe me. Please help me save your people without hurting any of them. Tears ran down her cheeks. I want so much not to hurt anyone. Tenderly he drew her to him and let her sob against his shoulder. The people of the Midlands are fortunate to have you as their warrior. If we can find the thing we seek, and keep it from Darkon Rall until the first day of winter, he will die. No one else will have to be hurt, but we must have help to find it. The first day of winter. Child, that is not much time. This season withers away. The next will be here soon. I do not make the rules of life, honored elder. If you know the secret to stopping time, please tell me that I might make it so. He sat quietly, without an answer. I have watched you among our people before. You have always respected our wishes, never acted to bring us harm. It is the same with the Seeker. I am on your side, child. I will do my best to win over the others. I only hope my words to them will be enough. I wish my people to come to no harm. It is not the Seeker or me you must fear if they say no, she said as she lay against his shoulder, staring off at nothing in particular. It is the one from Dahara. He will come like a storm and destroy you. You have no chance against him. He will butcher you. That night, in the warmth of Savidlin's home, sitting on the floor, Caelan